James 1:2-1:8 and 4:1-4:4, the 13th talk in a series on prayer, was presented by Ron Julian on March 21, 1999, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Well, we're going to continue in our series looking at various passages that talk about prayer. We're going into familiar territory today for me. There are three passages in the book of James that are very influential in the church's thinking about prayer, I think. They show up a lot in discussions about what sort of thing prayer is, and so I think we need to go and look at those. I have to confess, when it comes to these passages, that the very points that we want to talk about, the points that directly tell on how we think about prayer, are the points that are the most difficult to understand in the passages that we're going to look at. So I feel like I am coming to an understanding of what these passages are talking about in general, and I think I'm getting a handle on somewhat of what they have to say about prayer, but actually they're very difficult. I think they're among the most difficult passages that say anything about prayer in the Bible to kind of get a hold of exactly what are the implications of this. What exactly is it that it's saying? So, I want to discuss it with you. I don't know how many of these we'll get to today. We'll just kind of take them one at a time. And I also have the difficulty, of course, that I know in this group we have a mixture of people who have heard me talk about James so many times that you could mouth it with me as we go through these passages, and some of you who have not maybe ever heard me talk about it, and you have no idea what I'm talking about. So I'm going to try to aim somewhere in there that I can manage to explain what I'm talking about in these passages without putting some of you to sleep. So that's my goal. I don't know if I'll reach it or not. The place we want to start to begin is in the very beginning of the book, starting in the second verse. Very well-known passage. James says, "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. And let perseverance have a perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith, without any doubting. For the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways." Our particular concern in this passage is the prayer for wisdom that he talks about here. And in particular, I think the thing we want to try to nail down is this concept that we must ask in faith without any doubting. That's the thing that gets most of our attention, I think, when we read that. Many of us, I think, asking whether we have ever asked for anything with the amount of certainty that James seems to be implying here. There's a very popular way of understanding passages like this, and we've talked about this a lot in this series as we've talked about various passages, but the picture is something like this. Okay, as a Christian, you are saved and going to heaven. you exercised this nominal, I won't say nominal, but this regular sort of reasonable amount of faith. You heard the gospel and you believed it. You believe that Jesus is the Messiah, and by virtue of that fact, you're going to enter into salvation. But the big question that we're concerned about is, what are we missing out on now? What is there about being a Christian that could be true about me now, but is not? There's a lot, unfortunately, I would say, a lot of teaching out there that centers on that question. Okay, we've got this salvation thing licked, but what is it going to take to get your life in gear? How can you find happiness? How can you find whatever that thing you're looking for that's going to make things work for you now? There's this condition that needs to be met in order for you to find those things that you're looking for. And that condition is, you have to have this kind of faith with no doubt. You have to believe and be certain that you're going to get this thing that you're asking for. A lot of times the emphasis is on wealth or health or happiness. Here, this passage is sometimes used a certain view of wisdom. God will tell me what I need to know to make my life successful. Wisdom would mean knowing which road to go down, what choices to make, which stocks to buy. I mean, you know, pick whatever you might put there. And the idea is that God will give me this kind of wisdom that leads to success in life if I believe totally that He is going to do it. And I know for a fact that I am not setting up a straw man when I describe this. Just go and turn on the TV to some Christian television station right now, and I bet that you will find somebody who is giving a pep talk to a group of people, telling them you don't have to have these lives of futility and frustration and poverty and unhappiness. And the way to achieve your goal is to get the doubt out. You have to believe that God is going to bless you. That's the condition that has to be met in order to receive the blessing. So, my job then as a teacher is to convince you to banish from your mind any thought that you might not get as rich as you want to be. I wish I could say I'm exaggerating, but I'm not exaggerating. That's a very clear theme. Not everywhere. Goodness, you don't understand me to be saying that, you know, this little church is the only place in the world that is not teaching that. That's not true. But there's a lot of that out there. And even when it's not taught explicitly from the pulpit, it's so much a part of the culture that we kind of pick it up in the air. We just sort of get this idea that somehow that's the thing that God wants for us. And that picture of God sort of standing back, wringing his hands, oh, I wish they would only believe me enough so that I could really get out there and give them all the stuff. This passage is often used to defend that kind of idea. In particular, the teaching about you have to ask in faith without any doubting. We give that a certain spin. It becomes a mental technique that we need to develop. I need to ask God with the certainty that He is going to do what I'm asking Him. God, I'm asking you, I really want to be wealthy and healthy and happy, and I'm not going to ask if it be your will, because that would be doubting. I'm going to ask confident that you are going to do it. And in fact, sometimes the teaching would emphasize that, you know, I can essentially command God to do this for me. That's how much confidence that I can have. What we need to do here is to back up and talk a little bit about what the context is in this passage and what it is that James is actually talking about. I think will give us a better perspective on what it is he's actually saying here. Because there is something very important that he's saying, but I think we have missed it if we emphasize that idea that somehow it's this state of mind. It's this, you know, I have banished from my mind all thought of failure, and that's how success is going to happen. That's not what this passage is saying. So, first of all, quick reminder about what it is that's happening in the book of James. James is writing this letter to a group of Christians, Jewish Christians in churches around the Mediterranean, evidently in response to what he sees as a growing set of problems in these communities. One of the big themes in the letter is the problem that they're facing with persecution by wealthy landowners of the time. The believers that he's writing to are predominantly poor, and they're facing persecution at the hands of those who have much more wealth and position in society. That kind of situation is the sort of situation that tests you. I mean, that's not easy to live with. That's difficult. And it forces you to confront the questions of what it is you really believe. What is your hope? What do you think is actually going to save you in the end? What is it that's going to make life work for you? James looks around and he's not encouraged by the results of the test as they've come in so far. What we see in the letter as pictured in his what he's describing about what he sees out there is we see people who are incredibly worldly, they're selfishly ambitious, they're bitterly jealous, they are murdering each other in their fighting and stabbing to get what it is they want in this world. When somebody even poorer than themselves comes into their congregation, they treat them with contempt because, hey, that person can't give me anything. But if someone wealthy were to come along, they give that person the seat of honor because, hey, maybe I'm going to get something out of it in return. This is the kind of behavior that James is speaking to. And what he's essentially telling them in this letter is that way of living is totally, totally out of sync with what it is you say you believe. And he essentially is calling them in this letter to ask themselves the question, do you really believe this gospel or not? Because if you do, then why is it that you're living as if that gospel were not true? That's what the letter is about. A very stern letter, a very sober letter, because the situation he sees out there is so serious that he's calling on them to examine themselves and ask whether they really believe this stuff. This is the letter that has the famous section about faith and works, where he asks the question, what use is it if a man says he has faith but he has no works? And we've talked about that passage here before, but he's calling on them essentially to confront the reality that sooner or later, if you believe this stuff, it's going to have an effect on the way you live. You can't tell me that you believe that the treasure is down the right-hand fork in the road, but every time you come to that fork in the road, you go left. Sooner or later, we have to ask the question, if you really believe that it's over there, then why do you keep going over here? That's the thing that we have to confront. That's what the letter is about. Now, he starts out talking to them about this idea of the testing of our faith. Difficult times like the ones that they're going through are an opportunity to live out their faith. For instance, if the issue is poverty and persecution, if you find yourself low on the totem pole in this world, remember what it is that God is doing for you if you have put your faith in His promises. He is leading you into life for eternity. He is giving you that which this world could never give you. That's the reality. And that's what I am wrestling with as I look at the losses I face in this world versus the promises of God. This is your opportunity, he's saying, to wrestle with this question. Do I really believe this? To hang on to the promises of God. And through that process, we see the reality of the faith that is in us. We see that we really do have something in us that will not let go of the promises of God. But we also, through that process, start to mature and grow up in our faith. And this is something that we talk about a lot when we go through the book of James. This idea that it's in those tough times, with the wrestling and failure and struggles that are involved there, that I am confronted, I'm put face to face with the issues of the faith, and through that process, over time by wrestling with those questions and coming out on the right side, by deciding, yes, I really do believe this, I come out a person whose understanding has been strengthened. I understand better what's going on. The promises of the gospel have moved from being a more internal, intellectualized set of promises, which I truly believe, but that they have moved out into the world, and I have seen the implications of those promises for my life. And so there's a strength that comes from that. There's a wisdom and maturity that comes from that. That's what I think James is describing in the beginning. This is why the testing of our faith is such a valuable thing to go through, because it tests us, it shows the reality of the faith at work in us, but it also matures us and brings us to wisdom. And that is a desirable outcome as well. Now, I'm not going to talk about all of the specific phrases in this section and why I think they mean what I'm saying that they mean. I'd be happy to talk to any of you about that, but I have talked about that a lot around here, and today I want to concentrate specifically on this passage that talks about praying. So, James sees the process that God takes us through, the testing of our faith, the struggle, the thinking hard that has to happen in that process, and the ultimate wisdom that results from that. He sees that as the normal way that God deals with his people. When he comes to the place in the passage where he says, "If any of you lacks wisdom," he is addressing the very sorts of worldly, jealous, backstabbing people that we have seen pictured in the letter. When he says, "If any of you lacks wisdom," he's saying, what if you look at your life and say, in fact, James, the process you're describing has not happened. I do not see myself persevering in my faith under trial and growing in wisdom. In fact, to my shame, as I hear the message that you're proclaiming here, I recognize that I am the very sort of worldly fool that I should not be. What if that were true? What if you lack wisdom? What if you have not grown up into this maturity that he is describing? This is not an uncommon situation. I'm saying this partly by the evidence of the scriptures, as we look at the people pictured in the Bible, the letters written to believing communities. There are very few letters written to believing communities that are filled with nothing but, hey, you guys have got it all right, you are so strong and wise and in your faith, you know, I really don't have anything to tell you, you know, I'm going to come and just hang around and watch you guys for a while to see how it ought to be done. That's not there, because the Corinthians and the Colossians and the Galatians, I mean, you just over and over, one way or another, the people that are written to, there are all kinds of problems among them. You have a group of people who have embraced the faith, but that's just the first step. And now we're sorting out, do I really believe this stuff? Is this really mine? Is this really what I want out of life? And we see a lot of thrashing in the midst of that. And experience would suggest that things haven't changed from the time of the Bible. From my perspective, most of the people that I know, the believers that I know, and the extent that they have given me some sort of picture into the process of their lives, we have all thrashed along the way. We don't, at least I'm not prepared to say it never happens, but it doesn't seem to me very common for someone to become a believer, to sort of glide into maturity with the little struggle or effort and end up being, you know, a hero of the faith without some serious struggles, failure, and wrestlings along the way. I think James means to be encouraging here, as much as he's being sober and calling them to examine themselves. He sees that even the kind of worldliness and foolishness that he sees among the people that he's writing to does not necessarily mean that they are not believers or that the case is closed on their lives. He's saying to them, look, what if you find yourself in that spot? It's not such an uncommon spot to be, and there is hope. And the first point he makes, the point that I think is meant to be encouraging and consoling, is that God is generous and forgiving. When he says to ask God for wisdom, who gives to all men generously and without reproach, the emphasis there is, as I understand what he's saying, is on the generously and without reproach. God is prepared to forgive. He's not going to hold it against you. So he's urging them, as they look at the wreckage of their attempts so far to be people of faith, to turn to God with the confidence that is based on their understanding of his open arms, his willingness to forgive and accept them. So the first part of what he's saying is meant to be that encouraging sort of thing, that God is prepared to forgive you. But he has another point that he wants to make. And this is the tricky part. I think at this point I understand what he's doing. I have gone back and forth in my own thinking on how to put this together. First of all, I think we need to understand that there are two reasons why a person might be a fool, as he's describing it. There are two reasons why people's lives might be filled with the sort of worldliness that he is describing in this letter. One of those reasons is, although you genuinely believe, you are weak and immature and have not yet figured out what God's promises really mean. I mean, all of us go through that period of time. None of us are really profoundly transformed by the gospel at first. We are transformed, but we are still all too ready to think about life in very worldly terms, the terms on which we have always thought about life. So the folly, the foolishness, the worldliness that he's seeing among them, he's saying, look, that might be just the process of growing up, an immaturity, a faith that has not yet really come to terms with what this is all about. But there's another reason why you might be a fool, and that's because you're not a believer at all. Because every time you have the opportunity to see the implications of your faith for your life, the reason that you don't see those implications and it has no impact on your life is because you really don't believe it at all. Not in any significant sense. You are not prepared to trust God. You are not prepared to believe his promises. And so his promises have no impact on you in the midst of life because you're not letting them in. You refuse to let them in. So I think what James is saying here, given that reality, is look, I'm saying that God is ready and willing to forgive. You see folly in your own life. Ask him for wisdom. Turn to him, looking for his forgiveness, and say, forgive me for being a fool and bring me to wisdom. But I think what he's saying here is, look, essentially, in that prayer, you are confronting the same issue that you have been confronting out there in your life. Sooner or later, you're going to have to believe God. You're calling on him for wisdom. But if you don't really believe that he's there, and that he is good, and that he keeps his promises, and that he cares for you, and that he will grant you the wisdom that you are asking for, because that is exactly what he is committed to doing for his people, then don't expect that you're going to get anything from God. This is James' way of making sure that he doesn't communicate the wrong thing in what he said about the forgiveness of God. Saying, I'm saying that God will accept and forgive a fool. He will not accept and forgive an unbeliever. I'm not saying, hey, James said God will give us wisdom, so I'll crank off a little prayer for wisdom and see what happens. No, here is my opportunity again, like all the other testing situations in my life, to confront the question, do I believe God or not? James pictures doubt in various ways that I think help us to see the kind of thing he's getting at. Most helpful is that picture of the surf, the waves driven and tossed by the wind. you have this insubstantial little piece of water that gets thrown up, and whichever way the wind is blowing, that's the way the water gets blown. That's what he's talking about. And it's that picture of the lack of substance. Certainly the ocean has plenty of substance, that big mass of water, but you take a wave thrown up in the wind, what is it that determines where the water goes? Is it the strength of purpose of that water? I'm going that way, I don't care what the wind says. No, it's the wind's blowing that way, I'm going this way. The wind's blowing that way, well, I guess I'm going that way. What he's talking about is that lack of reality, that lack of stability to a faith, that a faith that has enough reality to it that it pushes back against the pressures against it. Other words that he uses here, wavering, double-minded, unstable, all of them having to do with that lack of decidedness. I don't know. When I'm in church, you know, the stuff about God, that sounds good. I feel better. I like it. But of course, when I'm out in the middle of my life from day to day, you know, I got to look out for number one, and, you know, I don't want to, let's not get fanatical about this. I mean, after all. Well, that's what James means by double-mindedness. It's whatever circumstance you're in dictates what you're about. It feels good to believe in God in church, and so I do. And it feels good not to believe in church, believe in God out in the rest of my life, so that's what I do. That's double-mindedness. That's like the wave driven and tossed by the wind. I am convinced, as I read this and I try to understand what James is talking about, that he is not talking about a mental technique, and he is not calling for perfect faith. He's not saying, by rejecting double-mindedness, he is not implying that in order to get anything from God, I have to have a faith that is perfect in its strength and maturity. It is a faith that is operative every single second of my life. I never have anything but the strongest confidence that God is who He is and He will keep His promises every single moment of my life. And if I have anything less than that, then I'm double-minded. He's calling for real faith, not perfect faith. It may get buffeted. It may have its struggles along the way, but it has a reality so that ultimately the pressures on it do not force it in the direction it does not want to go. It is a faith that is real enough that in spite of the temptation to not believe, nonetheless I believe. In spite of the pressures to turn away, I don't turn away. That's what he's talking about. Something that has stability and reality. So, in the midst of their lives, many of the Christians that he's writing to have been fools, and they have basically been living as if God were not there and his promises were not real. But now, he's saying to them, as you face into your own failure, you've heard me, you know what I'm saying, will you believe his promises now? Will you believe that he is generous and forgiving? Will you believe that he can and will lift you out of your confusion and strengthen your faith? It's the same issue you've been facing all along. Is God really there? Can you count on him? He is not calling for some special mental technique where I eliminate all thought that I won't get what I want. He is urging them to respond to the promise of God's forgiveness and granting of wisdom to fools like themselves, to the same way that they should, in the same way that they should respond to the promises of the gospel itself. They should respond with faith. They are called upon to believe what God has said. It's not a unique kind of faith. It's not some special technique. It's not a perfect faith that has banished all possibility of doubt. It is what we know and understand in this life as belief. I have heard it, I have believed it, and I will hold to it. That's what he's calling on them to do. So, the picture that we get of prayer here is not some special thing. This is just, look, you recognize the folly that has characterized your life. Look to God for deliverance. Look to Him to bring you to maturity and wisdom. And what I'm saying is you need to listen to that promise that God will do that with the same faith that you ought to itself. It's time for you to grab hold of the promises of God. Okay, that's the first passage that I wanted to talk about. I think what I would like to do is try one more. It's a shorter one, and then we'll talk a little bit about what I've said here. So the second one I want to look in at is in James chapter 4, starting in the beginning of the chapter. What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. And you are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? The phrase that we're interested in here is, you do not have because you do not ask. This is a tough one for me. The three passages in James were talking about increase in difficulty as we go along. The first one was moderately difficult, and this one is very difficult, and the third one is extremely difficult. The problem is, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. There are whole churches that are built on this verse. You don't have because you don't ask. Related to the kind of idea we were talking about in the first passage, the picture of two classes of Christians, the haves and the have-nots. And what I want to make sure is that I am not in the class of the have-not Christians, but I want to be in the class of the have Christians. The have-nots are the ones who haven't figured out that God has all this stuff for them. They don't have because they don't ask. If they would just ask, then they could have much more than what they have right now. So they're saved, but they're going without because they haven't asked for it. I think that's a misunderstanding and an oversimplification of what's going on in this passage. Let me tell you what I feel confident about, and then we can explore the more difficult question here. First of all, we have to understand to whom James is talking here. These are people, he's just described them as in their lust and desire for the things of this world, they are murdering each other. I mean, not every one of them is a murderer, but this is happening among them. This is a part of what James is seeing. These are the people that he's been writing to where he's asking questions like, what use is it if a man says he has faith but has no works? Notice he ends this section talking about you adulteresses. Don't you know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? He's not writing to them as if they are believers who haven't figured out the goodies that God has for them. He's writing to them as if they are worldly unbelievers whose claim to be believers is vastly undercut by their worldliness and lack of faith in the way they conduct their lives. That's the people that he's writing to. I cannot imagine that James is saying to them, you lust, you desire after things. You envy the people who have around you. You look at all the worldly riches and power and fame and all of that around you, and you desire it greatly, and you're killing for it, and you're fighting for it, and you're envious of those who have it. Your problem is you haven't figured out that God could give it to you if you just ask. You wouldn't have to go without. You don't have to be jealous. You can have it. You see what that guy has and you don't? Don't be jealous. Ask God. You can have it too. Problem solved. There's no way, there's no possible way that James is saying that. Read the letter. Read what he says about the fate of the rich. Read what he says about persevering under this trial. His message is not, you guys, this trial could be over if you would just ask God because you could be as rich as you want and you wouldn't suffer anymore. That is not his message. You guys have heard me say this a million times, but million and one times. That is not what James is saying. It cannot possibly be what James is saying unless he is totally wacko, unless he just does not know what he's talking about. His thinking is so inconsistent that he can say one thing over here and deny it over here the next minute. And I don't think that's what he's doing. That's what I know about this passage. Whatever it is he's saying, he's not saying that. So what is he saying? Okay. What is he saying? I don't know. I have a couple of thoughts on what he's saying. Notice he is saying, there is a sense in which he is saying, you desire and you envy and you don't have. You want, but you don't have. And then what he says to them is, you don't have because you don't ask. So he is, in a sense, proposing that God is the source of their lack. What they lack, they ought to be looking to him for. You don't have because you haven't asked. That's why you don't have. And he is saying that. What I am inclined to think that he means by that is that he's speaking, kind of, he's stepping back and looking in more general terms. Well, how are you guys looking at life? You feel a lack. There's so much that I don't have. I'm not happy. I'm not content. I'm not fulfilled. And I look around me and I see those who seem to have more than I have, and I think, if I could have that, then I'd be happy. And so I'm desirous and I'm jealous. And that leads me then to act in whatever ways that I can make up this lack. I'm jealous of you. Maybe I can maneuver myself into a position where I can get what you've got. Maybe it involves stepping on you a little bit. Well, how else am I going to fill this lack if I don't do that? Well, I think what James wants to say to them is, there's another way to fill that void, that sense that I want and I don't have. You can have, he's saying. You don't have because you haven't asked God. But I think he's not saying you don't have as much wealth and fame and power as you want, and if you ask God, he'll give it to you, in that sense. That, you know, I'm insanely jealous of Steven Spielberg for having all that success as a movie director and being one of the wealthiest people in the world and all of that stuff. I could be. Me, personally, I could be. I mean, Steven Spielberg is everything that I wanted to be and am not. But what if I got all of that? Just supposing right now I was to get all of that. I'm become a famous movie director and everybody knows my name and I have lots of money and critical success and, you know, I've already got my Oscar speech worked out and everything. What if that were to happen? I already know enough to know that there would be some great stuff about that. It would be very enjoyable for a while, and after things calmed down, I would still be me, and my problems would essentially go on unchanged. It doesn't really solve the problem. So I don't think James is saying you lust after all of that insubstantial stuff that can't really fulfill you, and if you ask, you'll get it. I think, though, that what he is saying is that thing that is driving you, that sense that I don't have, and so I've got to be out there grabbing, he's saying the reason you don't have is because you don't ask. If you understood who God was, his goodness, his power, his love, his promises and what they mean, you would ask, and he would give. Now, he doesn't mean he would give you all the money you want, but he means that sense, that lack, that loss that I feel, I turn to him to fill that, and he will do it. I think that's what he means. And we'll talk about that in a second. That's what seems to me to make the most sense. Then notice what he goes on to say. You ask and don't receive because you ask it with wrong motives, to spend it on your pleasures. Okay. First he said, okay, the reason you don't have is because you don't ask. Now let's think, wait a minute, James, that's not true. I've been asking God all the time and I don't have all the stuff I want. Well, he's saying, well, yeah, but now don't misunderstand me. This is his way of kind of correcting the impression that he might have made in the first one, that I can just ask for whatever I want and I'm going to get it. No. If your motives are wrong, as he goes immediately on to talk about the love of the world, if essentially I am driven by a love of the world and the love of the things of the world, and my desire is to have the things of the world so that I can indulge myself in whatever way I want, then, no, I'm not going to get that. Because my motives are wrong. That's not what God's about. That's not what I'm saying you're going to get. So what I can count on getting is not the things that are going to fulfill all the pleasures that I want to fulfill now, but something deeper, something better, something ultimately more satisfying and more life-giving. I think that's what James is saying. So, bottom line then, this is not the kind of statement that separates two classes of Christians, the haves and the have-nots. I don't think he's saying, hey Christian, stop going without, because you could have more if you would only go and ask God for it. Instead, he is talking to nominal Christians who in reality are living as if God does not exist and God's promises mean nothing. And what he's saying to them is essentially, you need to stop living as if God did not exist and turn to him. Ask him to fill the lack, the need in your life. And he will do it. So, you have not because you ask not is not a statement that is directed to Christians who are living in the slums of Christianity instead of in the uptown. This is directed to people, another way of confronting them with the question, will you believe or not? Every one of us here who is a genuine believer who has turned to God and looked to him for life, James would not say to them, you don't have because you haven't asked. Because we have asked. And God is in the process of fulfilling our request. So in a sense, it's bad news for you, I guess. I'm saying if you feel like you're living in the slums, I'm sorry, there is no uptown. This is just one big neighborhood. But on the other hand, it's powerfully important because ultimately, if we come to understand what James is saying, part of what he's saying to us is my impression that I'm living in the slums is mistaken. I am not. Because I am asking God and he is giving. Today he is giving. Not just someday he's going to give. Today he is at work in my life. He is teaching me. He is guiding me. He is protecting me. And he's giving me the things I need to live as well. I mean, every one of us in here is eaten and has some place to live, I think. I think God's doing a pretty good job of that, actually. God is giving if we have asked. But to ask means essentially to be a believer. That's what I think he's saying. It's difficult, but that's what makes the most sense to me out of the passage right now. Okay, so let me take some time then. We'll settle for two of these and see if any questions or comments that you might have. Margaret.
On the first passage that you talked about, is this correct? Is this what you're saying? That the you know, let him ask without in faith, without doubting, that what he's doubting is not that God will give him what he wants, What he doubts is that he really wants it.
That's a very good question. And I think that my answer today is no. That's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
That's what I used to say.
Okay.
As one who's been around for a while and has heard me talk about this a number of occasions, I can understand why you might think I'm saying that, because I have said that in the past. But certainly that enters into the picture. But I think it enters into it beforehand. I mean, if I don't really want the kind of wisdom that, if I'm not willing to recognize at all that I'm a fool, that I've been faithless and worldly and unbelieving in my life, and that's not the way I want it to be, then I'm not going to really hear James' exhortation here, and that's not the direction things are going to be going anyway. I think when he talks about asking in faith without any doubting, that he is talking about my belief, my faith, that God will do what I'm asking. In this case, give me wisdom. That's where I would put it now. But what's at stake there? What does that mean? That means these are people who, in their lives, up to now, have pushed aside the question of whether God's existence has any implications for their life. They have lived as if today is all that counts, what I have in this life is all that counts, and there is this great inconsistency between what they say they believe and what they're pursuing in their lives. Here, to look at the reality, I have been a fool. God is prepared to forgive and lead me into the wisdom that I have not been able to find so far. That means confronting in a serious way the question, is God really there? It's like what, I say this passage a lot from Hebrews, but I think it's a fundamental one. The one who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. That I have to, in this spot, come to believe that God is really there, that he is prepared to forgive, and that he will do what he has promised to do. So what I'm saying is, in this arena, this has kind of become a subset of the larger questions surrounding my faith. Is God there? Does he keep the promises that he has made? The gospel confronts me with a whole series of ideas about my sinfulness, God's reality, the power of what Jesus did on the cross, the value of the kingdom of God over what the world... I mean, all sorts of issues involved in the gospel. This question here confronts me with a subset of those. I'm confronting the issue, is God there? Does he keep his promises? Can I embrace this picture of me the sinner, me the fool, God the forgiver, reaching out and restoring me? Will I embrace that picture in a way that I have not really up to now in the way I've been living my life? That's what I understand him to be saying. Certainly it's involved with the question of whether I want those things, but it also involves the issue of will I come to the place where the reality of God and his promises is substantial enough that I'm counting on it in a significant way. I believe that God will save me from my folly, because I believe there's a God, and I believe he's good, and I believe he will forgive. So my belief in those things is not that, oh, if I could convince myself that God will give me a car, then he'll give me one. This is a more fundamental, I have every reason to believe that God is the way James has described him. That he is good, that I ought to be putting my trust in him, but I haven't. And, you know, just on and on, that picture. If I'm willing to embrace that picture and turn to God with the solid expectation that he is there and will respond, then I am a person of faith. And the funny thing about it in this scenario is my prayer to God for wisdom, I would argue, is going to be built on the foundation of the faith that I showed in asking for it. I mean, in a sense, the reality of the fact that I really did want that and see him as the source of that is going to be a part of the picture, ultimately, that is going to lead to that wisdom. So, come back to me then.
When I look at that picture, last year had my 20th anniversary as a Christian. I cannot say that I fit that perspective. And if I were a young Christian, I would chalk that up to, well, you know, just give it some time. But after 20 years, I'm, you know, it could be that I'm just have a screw loose or something, but I do think I am really a Christian. I think God has chosen me. And I cannot say that I have the emotional sense that whenever I ask God, save me, make me wise, or whatever, that I know he's going to do it. And so that...
No, wait.
You would think, you could reasonably ask me, well, don't you believe God is good? Don't you believe God fulfills his promises and that kind of thing? And I would say, yes, yes. Well, wouldn't it necessarily follow then that if God has promised me, if I truly am a Christian, and if God has promised that if I believe he will give me these things, shouldn't I have the emotional sense of when I go to him, of course God will give me this. He promised it. I think I'm a Christian. But when I obviously I'm making this argument so I can understand why somebody would ask that question.
Now, but don't go any farther because,
okay.
See, I'm not sure we're on the same wavelength here.
Okay.
Because how did we get to emotional confidence and knowing that it's going to happen? That's not what I meant.
Okay.
Are you saying that when you ask God to give you wisdom, you don't believe he will do it?
I don't have the subjective sense of confidence that he will do it. I know that if it's going to be done, he's going to have to do it. And I do know that he's good. But somewhere there is a gap there between... there is a gap there that is keeping me from having that confidence. I guess what I sort of, the mental image I have is when Jacob was wrestling with the angel. The angel is pulling all sorts of dirty tricks like dislocating his hip and that kind of thing. And he's holding on. He's saying, look, I'm not going to let you go until you bless me. Now, in the midst of that, could I say that Jacob knew that the angel, who's God, is in fact going to bless him? Well, it sure doesn't look like it. He's not doing it willingly. He's dislocating his hip and that kind of thing. On the other hand, so I can't say, I don't think it would be reasonable to expect that Jacob in that moment was confident that he was ultimately going to get blessed. However, one thing he was confident of was that if there was a blessing, it was going to have to come from this guy. So it was worth hanging on no matter what happened, because it was the only chance you had of getting blessed. So Jacob certainly was confident that blessings come from this guy and only from this guy. Now, was he confident that he was in fact going to get a blessing? Evidence indicates this. If it happens, it's not going to be easy. You know, he's not immediately coming forth and doing this. So I guess I sort of see myself in that situation. I am confident that if any blessing is going to happen, it's going to come from this guy. And it's worth hanging out through whatever happens in the chance that I might be one of those people that get blessed. But I cannot, maybe it's just my own lack of goodness. I can't put myself in God's position and imagine that he would do that. He has said he would do that, but he's got certain qualifications in mind. I'm not confident I have the qualifications. So at the same time, I see myself as having faith and seeing that God is good. But maybe it's that I'm my own. You know, Jacob couldn't say, I have the strength to hang on. As you know, he may dislocate my other hip. He may dislocate my shoulders. You know, I can't say through all that I'm going to hang on. But I can say that I know blessings come from this guy and that it's worth expending whatever effort I have to do in order to hang on. I just can't say I know I'm going to hang on, and that is one of the qualifications of getting blessed, and so that's the way it is.
Okay, but I think the picture you're painting from Jacob wrestling with the angel is a good one, a compelling one. But now, let's go to another one. Abraham sacrificing Isaac. Abraham, when he went to raise the knife, did not say to himself, I would argue, I think we're told that he did not say to himself this. Well, I don't know whether Isaac's going to live or not. I mean, I'm about to put a knife into him, so he's going to die, and he may not live. But I do know if anybody's going to raise him, it would have to be God. So I'll just have to count on that. He didn't have that attitude. His attitude was, if I kill Isaac, God will raise him from the dead. Now, what's the difference between him and Jacob? I would argue that in this case, Abraham had the specific assurance from God
to him
that he was going to respond, that he was going to do for Abraham what he had promised to do, and Isaac would be the source of that. So Abraham's faith in that situation resulted in, now, see, I'm going to be careful. This is a very tricky subject, Margaret, because I don't know that I would exactly call it emotional confidence in that situation. I would bet emotionally Abraham was a wreck in that situation. I think it's very unlikely that he had this sort of glowing confidence. I think there would have to have been something wrong with him if he did. I don't know if you've ever heard the song that Leonard Cohen wrote, called The Story of Isaac. It's Isaac in the first person describing the experience of being taken by his father to the top of the mountain. And essentially the picture he paints is of this, you know, this sort of blazing certainty of faith, this inhuman, you know, the father who is so certain that he's doing the right thing that he can't see, you know, what it is that's happening to his son. Well, I don't think that's the kind of person that Abraham was. But in spite of the emotional difficulties of what he was doing, he believed what God had told him about the promises that were involved. Now, the question is, okay, we've got the Jacob picture that you've described over here. We have the Abraham picture over here. The question is, I mean, for you specifically, but also for all of us, what does faith in God in our lives now, where on the continuum somewhere between Abraham and Jacob, where do we fit and how does that look? I think we have to start with the understanding this seems to me undeniably true, that more often than not, faith in the New Testament is described as being like Abraham. What Abraham did is what we are being called on to do. That is, to respond with an appropriate level of confidence to promises that have been made by God.